right, folks, welcome to According to Sam. This is episode 187 and happy President's Day. Happy Monday. We are now in week number two of the standoff to get Ukraine funding. The Speaker of the House last week, I think it was on Wednesday, offered to meet with President Biden and privately, man to man, face to face, to sit down and talk it over. And the Biden administration told Speaker Johnson that there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to negotiate. No, we don't want to meet with you. So the speaker called a recess. They're gone for 2 weeks. They're on vacation. And then Biden comes out today and says, yeah, I'm willing to meet after all. So I guess Speaker Johnson's supposed to cancel his vacation and come back to negotiate to get Ukraine funding. I mean, everything. They started like last week. I told you in that podcast about Mike Turner, the head of the Intelligence Committee, releasing intelligence about the Russians wanting to use space nukes to take out satellites. And then from the space nukes, what was the next trick that they came up with? There was something else that we have to pass this funding right now. Our national security is at risk. So when they first started this negotiation on this bill, it included, even though it was weak border security, and even if it was a great border security bill, I don't think that they should have done anything on the border part. But it wasn't. It wasn't a great bill. It allowed 5,000 people a day across the border, gave Joe Biden the power, to unilaterally shut down and open the border. There was a lot wrong with that border portion of the bill, but at least it included something in the bill about our southern border where there's an invasion going on. But now that that's not in the bill and that's been removed and you just pass all this stuff for Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel, and you're still calling it a national security bill? I mean, there's no bigger threat to our national security right now than our southern border. And Americans just are not buying this. It was interesting. Yesterday, Nikki Haley did this interview. I forget what Sunday show she was on. I think she was on with Hot Carl on ABC. On this week. And she said that Joe Biden, the reason that he asked her directly, why is it that Republicans do not support Ukraine? And she says, well, Joe Biden hasn't, used the bully pulpit. He hasn't gone to the people and explained why Ukraine is important to our national security. And I watched that and I was like, nothing could be further from the truth. This guy, Joe Biden, has made address after address trying to explain to us why Ukraine is important to our national security. And Americans just aren't buying it. At least Americans on the right, Republicans, just are not buying why Ukraine is a bigger priority to our national security than our southern border. He hasn't been able to sell that. It's not because he hasn't tried Nikki Haley. He's used the bully pulpit. And you would be no more effective at this than Joe Biden if you were president and you were trying to sell this Ukraine war to Republicans. Republicans are not buying it. Republican voters are putting pressure on members of the House not to pass another dime for Ukraine. So now there's a standoff. Now they're using deception and tricks. And and we are in the second week of this standoff to get Ukraine funding. Supposedly Ukraine is out of ammunition. They're withdrawing from major cities and they're losing, and the inevitable is happening. Russia is starting to gain ground because we won't pass funding to Ukraine. Go to the negotiating table, Zelensky. Sue for peace. I mean, Vladimir Putin said in the interview that he did with Tucker Carlson just last week that he's prepared to negotiate right now. But as I've been telling you, as I've shown you playing the clips from George Soros, that they're not ready to negotiate. Joe Biden is not ready to negotiate, and it's Joe Biden's fault and the West's fault. What's his name? Johnson, when Johnson was prime minister of England, that he put a roadblock against the peace agreement. So the West doesn't want peace. They're not ready for peace right now. So the war continues. And now they're calling everyone who doesn't support Ukraine Russian assets. You're doing Vladimir Putin's bidding and all of that. I don't care about Vladimir Putin. I'm not doing Vladimir Putin's bidding. I'm doing my bidding, our bidding here in the United States. America first, and take care of us, that we have domestic issues in this country. We don't want to be sending money, borrowing money to send all over the world when we have issues in this country that we need to care for. So now the big game or the big narrative is this Alexei Navalny guy. And Alexei Navalny, I guess he was a blogger who was critical of the government in Ukraine or in Russia, the Vladimir Putin government, and he was poisoned. They blamed the Russian government for poisoning him. He fled Russia and then came back to Russia. He had some affiliation with some nationalist groups, and then he left the ethno-nationalist movement. And that's when ethno-nationalist is another word to say neo-Nazi. Ethno-nationalists are neo-Nazis in Eastern Europe. So they're synonymous. So he had some affiliation with some of those groups and then, you know, left that particular movement and was still very critical of the Russian government, the Vladimir Putin government. And now they tell us that he is dead. And as I said on my Twitter page, he is the George Floyd of 2024. That I have not seen anyone's death be propagandized the way this guy's death is being propagandized since George Floyd in, ironically, the last election year. But his death is being propagandized now to move forward this aid package to Ukraine. I don't know. I mean, this guy's a Russian. He was a critic of the Putin government, but I don't understand what he has to do with Ukraine at all. But he is being used. This is a picture that I put up on Twitter. He is being used just like George Floyd was being used to advance this narrative, and not only a narrative, to advance this bill of $95 billion, $60 billion of which goes to Ukraine. So now, when the House comes back in session, they're on a two-week vacation. When they get back in session in 2 weeks, the plan is a discharge petition. And what Democrats are going to try to do is they're going to try to force this bill to the floor and force a vote on it. And I want you to listen to Nancy Pelosi tell you about this parliamentary procedure.
The Speaker Johnson has said he will not bring it up.
Our leader, Hakeem Jeffries, said that he has not ruled out using a discharge petition, which is a parliamentary maneuver to try to bring a bill to the floor and also to just see where all of the Republicans are on this, because we've had over 300 votes for assistance to Ukraine.
Listen to what she's saying. We've had over 300 votes for assistance to Ukraine. And when she was speaker, they had no problem passing any of it because you had, again, the entire Democrat caucus and you had enough Republicans who were on the take to pass it. So we had over 300. So there's no reason we shouldn't get it passed now. The difference is that you're not speaker anymore. And so this discharge petition, like she said, parliamentary trick. She knows all the tricks. If you remember, she also during the Obamacare debate, if you guys don't remember, that the Senate had passed a bill and the House had passed a bill, and they were trying to combine the two bills. And then Ted Kennedy dies. And then after Kennedy dies, they didn't have a filibuster proof majority. And it was her idea to use reconciliation. So she knows all the parliamentary tricks. Nancy Pelosi knows them all. So this is a maneuver that they're going to try, a discharge position to pass a bill for $95 billion when we're $34.3 trillion in debt. The debt to GDP is 130%. The interest on the debt is $1 trillion annually. They want to borrow another $95 billion to send abroad to put gas on this fire, to pour gas on the fire in Ukraine. So Ukraine's the priority. So that's why we've been talking about Ukraine. And we're going to get back into talking about how this started, how this entire war started in 2014, and how we got involved. Now, I emphasize and I keep saying this, I was saying this in the last podcast, even at the end of the podcast before that, that I want you to understand what's going on here in Kyiv is not being received the same way here in Odessa, here in Crimea, here in Donbass region. That these people are watching this coup d'etat, this slow-moving coup d'etat take place in their capital. They've seen it before because it's reminiscent to what happened in 2004 with the Orange Revolution. George Soros has called all of these civil society demonstrators out to Independence Square, the Maidan, to protest the fact that Yanukovych has rejected a trade association with the EU, and he has accepted a trade agreement with Russia. And George Soros has called over 100,000, almost 200,000 people. The United States is involved because John McCain, Republican senator, and Christopher Murphy, Democrat senator, are there meddling in their business. And that's how all of this started. And again, you have to think about January 6th. Think about January 6th and the protesters on January 6th that were storming the Capitol and committing violence. Think about what if they were successful, if they would have been able to if that was really their goal, and I don't believe that was their goal at all to overthrow the government, but think about if they were able to overthrow the government and force the Congress to flee, and then they take over the Congress when the people who were duly elected by the rest of the country, those people have to leave and flee, is what happened to Yanukovych and his government. They had to flee. And then the people that cause them to flee take over and seize the government. Think about January 6th, and that's happening in Washington. And you're in wherever you live, in Texas, in California, in New York, and you're watching that happen on TV. You know, that's the way you got to put yourself in the shoes of these people in Odessa, in Crimea, in Donbass, when they're watching this coup take place in Kyiv. A coup that's being organized by civil society, George Soros, and the West. They see, I mean, at the same time they're seeing that go on, they're seeing John McCain and Chris Murphy on their TV, these people in these regions of Crimea. So they see that the West is involved. They see that it's a coup going on, and a lot of them don't agree with it. You have to put yourself in their shoes, because after the coup happens, these people become very significant. All right. Another thing that you need to understand, that Russia, this naval base here in Sevastopol, let me come up here so I can show you. Right here. Sevastopol. This naval base. This naval base has been part of Russia since the late 18th century. Since Catherine the Great, they have had this base in Sevastopol. So you got to understand that too, that this naval base is a strategic naval base in the Black Sea that has been part of Russia since the late 18th century, since Catherine the Great. I got to understand that too. So you have to take these people's perspective watching the coup going on in these areas. And you got to understand that this naval base has been part of Russia since the late 18th century. So, and Russia's not going to give that strategic naval base up. So you got to understand all of that, because it becomes very significant after the coup. All right, let's listen to Vladimir Putin again talk about the coup and how it went down.
However, the issue of the association with the EU came up. We have always been lenient to this, suit yourself. But when we read through the Treaty of Association, it turned out to be a problem for us, since we had a free trade zone and open customs borders with Ukraine, which under this association had to open its borders for Europe, which could have led to flooding of our market. We said, no, this is not going to work. We shall close our borders with Ukraine then. The customs borders, that is. Yanukovych started to calculate how much Ukraine was going to gain, how much to lose, and said to his European partners, I need more time to think before signing. The moment he said that, the opposition began to take destructive steps, which were supported by the West.
The opposition began to take destructive steps that were supported by the West. What is he talking about there? He's talking about the fact that George Soros called 100,000 people out to Maidan to protest because Yanukovych was considering doing the deal with Russia, and it was supported by the West. No lie there. There's no lie when Putin says that as soon as Yanukovych started to renegotiate this trade deal and accept the agreement from Russia, the opposition, civil society, George Soros, called all these people out, and it was supported by the West. There's the West. All right, more Putin here.
It all came down to Maidan and a coup in Ukraine.
It all came down to Maidan. This is Maidan right here. This is Maidan where all these people, where George Soros called all of these people. That's Maidan.
The West. It all came down to Maidan and a coup in Ukraine.
So he did more trade with Russia than with the EU.
Jeez, dude.
Ukraine did.
Tucker, really, I swear, some of the questions that he asked in this interview, I'm like, man.
So he did more trade with Russia than with the EU. Ukraine did.
Ну, конечно. Ну, конечно, конечно.
Of course. It's not even the matter of trade volume, although for the most part it is. It is the matter of cooperation size, which the entire Ukrainian economy was based on. The cooperation size between the enterprises were very close since the times of the Soviet Union. One enterprise there used to produce components to be assembled both in Russia and Ukraine, and vice versa. They used to be very close ties. A coup d'etat was committed, although I shall not delve into details now, as I find doing it inappropriate, the U.S. told us.
So he says a coup d'etat happened. I'm not going to get into the details. We're going to get into the details here. We've already been getting into the details in the past couple of podcasts. But so there's a standoff. There's a standoff between all of the people who George Soros and civil society call out to Maidan, and then the Yanukovych government. There's two different factions. There's the Yanukovych, the government, the legitimate government that was elected, that was not only elected by the people in Kiev, that was elected by all of the people of Ukraine, fairly elected Yanukovych and his government. So the two factions are Yanukovych and his government and his police force and the protesters who civil society, George Soros, called together to the square. There's still no violence. These people camped there in Maidan. I mean, they stayed there day and night. They camped. George Soros and civil society supplied all the food, all the supplies they need. They cooked there. They ate there. They were there for weeks. No violence. No violence at all. And the violence doesn't start. All of the protesters start going to Maidan Square. All of this starts taking place in early December of 2013. The violence doesn't start until there's not actual violence until February 20th of 2014. So they were there for almost 11, 12 weeks with no violence. All right, listen to more of what Putin says here.
A coup d'etat was committed, although I shall not delve into details now, as I find doing it inappropriate, the U.S. told us. Calm Yanukovych down, and we will calm the opposition.
So listen, the United States government, the Obama administration, this is Obama in 2014, they are negotiating on behalf of the protesters in the square. That George Soros called. The Obama administration is communicating with Russia and telling Russia, you call off your dogs and we'll calm down our dogs. That he says, this is what Putin is saying, that the Obama administration told us, if you calm down Yanukovych, we'll calm down the protesters. Listen to what Putin says here again.
Not delve into details now, as I find doing it inappropriate, the U.S. told us. Calm Yanukovych down, and we will calm the opposition. Let the situation unfold in the scenario of a political settlement. We said, all right, agreed, let's do it this way. As the Americans requested, Yanukovych did use neither the armed forces nor the police, yet the armed opposition committed a coup in Kiev.
Well, listen to what Putin says there. Very important that as the United States said that listen, this is what John McCain and Christopher Murphy said back in December, that if there's any violence, we're prepared to sanction you. So we're requesting that Yanukovych do not use any violence to clear the people. We had no right to even be over there telling him not to use violence to clear the people out of the square. Who are we? You guys know anything about the bonus army that happened in 1932 when veterans, United States veterans of World War I, that Woodrow Wilson promised them that they would get a bonus for fighting in that war, but he thought they were all going to die before the bonus came due, and they outlived the bonus, and the government was supposed to pay all these veterans all this money and bonuses that were promised to them. So they went to Washington to protest, and they camped in front of the Capitol just the way the people in Maidan were camped. And the Herbert Hoover, who was president at that time, told Douglas MacArthur and General Patton, who used force, bayonets, tear gas to clear these violence to clear the veterans. We had no right to be over there telling them that they could not use violence to clear the square. Nothing that Yanukovych was doing. He had every right to negotiate a trade deal with Russia and pull out of the trade deal. Yeah, I mean, if he wanted to use violence the way we did in 1932, we had no right to be over there. But we went over there and we said that we're going to sanction you if you use violence. Don't use violence. And what Putin is saying, that as the government of the United States requested, Yanukovych didn't use violence. So who did start the violence? How did the violence start? George Soros, if you remember last week when I played it, the story that he told is that Yanukovych had already fled and went to Sochi to meet with Putin. And then after he had already fled, that Putin's the one who ordered Yanukovych to use live ammunition. That's not true. I mean, no one who knows anything about this believes that Putin ordered Yanukovych to use live ammunition, or that Yanukovych would have listened to Putin or had to listen to Putin in that regard. So someone started using live ammunition. We have the standoff. We have the protesters, and the protesters that were at the square consisted of two factions. Let's remember the two factions that were included in the protesters. Take a listen to this clip again from last week about the Nazis.
The people who brought down the government were overwhelmingly ordinary Ukrainians, students and doctors, workers and even families.
The people who brought down the government were overwhelmingly just ordinary people, students, doctors, just ordinary family people. They were overwhelmingly, and again, back to the way they pulled off Black Lives Matter in 2020. The protesters for the Black Lives Matter protests were overwhelmingly peaceful protesters, just average everyday people, overwhelmingly, just like here in Ukraine in 2014. But there was another smaller faction that was more effective. That's what they say in this clip.
The people who brought down the government were overwhelmingly ordinary Ukrainians, students and doctors, workers and even families, people who simply refused to back down. But the most organized and perhaps the most effective were a small number of far-right groups. When it came to confrontations with the police, it was often the nationalists who were the loudest.
It was often the nationalists. And again, like I said, ethno-nationalists in Eastern Europe is synonymous with neo-Nazis. You see the SS right here, SS. So when he says ethno-nationalists, he's talking about neo-Nazis. So there's two factions. Just like when Black Lives Matter in 2020, you had the peaceful, overwhelmingly peaceful protesters, that faction, and then you had the Antifa element that happened at night. That was, they were doing the violence, setting fires, the looting, two different factions. Same thing in Ukraine. You had the overwhelmingly peaceful protesters that were there, and then you had the factions of neo-Nazis. So the two factions were standing off, and they had been there for weeks, like I said, camping there. And this was going on for weeks, started in early December again. And the violence doesn't really kick off until February 20th. February 20th is when live ammunition starts to be fired. And the question that we're going to ask now is, who started firing? Who is the first faction to start shooting? George Soros says that Yanukovych had fled to Sochi to meet with Putin, and Putin ordered him to start the shooting, so that it was the Yanukovych government that started the shooting. The West, most people in the West, they tell the same narrative that George Soros told, that it was the Yanukovych government and they're the ones who started shooting. The Nazis were armed, well armed, but I don't even believe that the Nazis were the ones who started the shooting. But once the shooting did start, they were very well prepared and armed so they could shoot back. So the Nazis weren't the ones who started the shooting, but everyone in the West says it was the Yanukovych government that started the shooting. Let's listen to what Putin says when Tucker asked him about who started the shooting. Listen.
Forces nor the police, yet the armed opposition committed a coup in Kiev. What is that supposed to mean? Who do you think you are? I wanted to ask the then U.S. leadership.
With the backing of whom?
With the backing of CIA, of course. The organization you wanted to join back in the day, as I understand.
Love that part. Everyone loved that part, man, because Tucker did want to join the... He's admitted this, that he wanted to join the CIA. So with the backing of who is what Tucker says, and Putin says the CIA. And I believe that Putin is alluding to in this moment that he believes that the CIA started the shooting, or someone who may have been hired by Western intelligence. It's kind of like the shot heard around the world, that if you know the story about the Battle of Lexington, one of the first battles of the American Revolution, that the Patriots, the American rebels, they were facing off against the Redcoats, the British, and they were just like, you know, these two different factions in at Maidan that were facing off for weeks there in Ukraine. At Lexington, the two different factions, the Patriots were facing off against the Redcoats, and they were there with their arms drawn, and nobody knows who shot the first shot. To this day, people do not know who shot that first shot, the shot heard around the world, but that shot is what started off the entire revolution, even though this is a story that they tell. The revolution was well on its way by the time Lexington and Concord happened, but that was one of the earliest battles, and it started with the shot heard around the world. Nobody knows who fired that first shot. Was it the British, a British soldier? Was it an American soldier? But whoever fired that first shot kicked off the entire war. Well, that's what happened in Ukraine. In Ukraine, whoever fired that first shot on the morning of February 20th is the one who started the current war that is going on in Ukraine right now. That person, whoever fired that shot, started the war that's going on right now in 2024. So who fired that first shot? Well, this is a BBC report. And like I said in the last podcast, the BBC, Canada, other news agencies around the world did excellent reporting on what happened in Euromaidan, the beginning of Euromaidan. Our media, not so much. The American people, who are paying more than anyone else for this war, know the least about how this war started and how we got involved in this mess. Take a listen to this BBC report.
These are the scenes that triggered the breakup of Ukraine. Scenes that have brought the world to the brink of a new Cold War. Unarmed protesters gunned down in the streets by the riot police, who were retreating from Kiev's Maidan Square.
So that is one thing, by the riot police. So the riot police are shooting, but the shooting had already started at this point.
By the end of the day, more than 50 people were dead, including three policemen. Ukraine's new leaders maintain that responsibility for the shootings lies entirely with the security forces acting on behalf of the previous government. Our investigations suggest that is not the full picture.
Listen to that. That's very important what they're saying. This is BBC. First of all, they say that it was the security forces. Security forces are the Yanukovych government, that they're the ones that are at fault. And then they say that you know, the picture in the West is that the Yanukovych government, the security forces, they're the ones who are responsible. But our reporting, this is what BBC says, our reporting shows that that's not the full picture. Again, let's listen to this.
Including three policemen. Ukraine's new leaders maintain that responsibility for the shooting lies entirely.
So I want to say this too. When they say Ukraine's new leaders, these are the new Nazi government that we installed as soon as the coup happened. As soon as Yanukovych and his government had to flee, the new government that took control before any elections took place. So you got to understand this, that once the coup happens, Yanukovych and his government flees, the civil society and new government people that we put in power there, they're a Nazi government, that they're the ones who are in power in the interim before they can get an election. And the Obama administration's objective is to get the first election to happen immediately. This is exactly what happened in Iraq as well. As soon as Bush invades Iraq, his objective was immediately to have elections. And so after the coup in 2014 in Ukraine, Obama's objective was to immediately, as soon as we can, stage elections. We need to have elections because elections are going to legitimize the government. You can't go in and start calling it a democracy until you have elections. So they're telling you that they're fighting for democracy and this is all democracy. So in the beginning, the government that we installed, the Yanukovych or the Yaksenyuk government, the interim government was a government of Nazis. So when the BBC says that the new government is blaming the old government for the shooting, that's who they're talking about, the Nazis who we installed.
By the end of the day, more than 50 people were dead, including three policemen. Ukraine's new leaders maintain that responsibility for the shootings lies entirely with the security forces acting on behalf of the previous government. Our investigations suggest that is not the full picture. Only three people have been arrested over the killings, all of them members of this police unit, seen firing here towards the protesters. That was after 9 o'clock in the morning, as government forces retreated from the square. But what prompted the police to pull back? Earlier that morning, Andrei Shevchenko, then an opposition politician and part of the Maidan movement, had received a call from the police commander on the square.
He calls me and he says, Andrei, someone is shooting at my guys. And he said that the shooting was from the conservatory. He said, second floor, it's firearms, and please do something about that, because it's getting really bad.
The conservatory building was under the control of the protesters. On the morning of the 20th, there were persistent...
So the protesters, the civil society, George Soros people are the ones who had control of this building, according to BBC. Listen again.
Please do something about that, because it's getting really bad.
The conservatory building was under the control of the protesters. On the morning of the 20th, there were persistent reports of gunfire coming from there. Now, for the first time, one of those gunmen has spoken on camera. He was part of the protest movement, he said, and agreed to talk to us on condition that we disguise his identity. We will call him Sergei.
I was shooting downwards at their feet. Of course I could have hit them in the arm or anywhere, but I didn't shoot to kill. I also shot upwards at the police who were on top of the Globus shopping center.
So listen to what this guy's saying, that BBC is interviewing, and he won't show his face, whatever, but he's saying that he was shooting at the protesters and he was shooting at the police. I think that's what he's saying, that he was shooting down at the protesters and that he was shooting at the police. Let's listen again. I think that's what this guy's saying.
Shoot to kill. I also shot upwards at the police at their feet.
To us on condition that we disguise his identity. We will call him Sergei.
I was shooting downwards at their feet.
Yeah, so I'm shooting downwards at their feet. So I'm shooting at the feet of the protesters, of the Nazis, of the civil society protesters that have gathered there. I'm shooting downward at their feet is what he says.
Of course I could have hit them in the arm or anywhere, but I didn't shoot to kill. I also shot upwards at the police.
And then, so I turned my gun. So I was shooting down at the protesters. Then I turned my gun upwards to shoot at the police. That's what this guy's saying.
Who were on top of the Globus shopping center. And that is why they...
So this guy, whoever this guy is that BBC is talking to, he was shooting at both sides. He was shooting at downward. He says, of course I could have hit them, but my objective is not to hit them. I just want to get the shooting started. So I'm shooting down at the protesters, and then I'm also shooting up at the police. I don't want to hit them either. I just want to get the shooting started. Prime the pump of the shooting. I want to prime the pump for the shooting. So I'm shooting down at the protesters, shooting up at the police, not interested in hitting them. Just want to, start the shooting. And then once we start the shooting, they don't know where the shooting is coming from, and they're going to start shooting at each other. And that's exactly what happened.
Sergei says that he took up a position behind one of these pillars here. And he mentions being able to see that clock over there on the far side of the square on the bank and the edge of the shopping centre, which was the part of the square that was controlled by the riot police. So from here, he had a bird's eye view right over the front line.
Amid the chaos, the man in charge of security at the protest camp sent his men to search the conservatory building.
They went and checked all the floors. Roughly half an hour later, they returned and told me there were no firing positions from the conservatory.
Lawyers and prosecutors say their attempts to find out what really happened on that day are being blocked by the courts. In the absence of a thorough and transparent investigation, conspiracy theories flourish. Ukrainians believe the shootings on the 20th were a provocation, planned and orchestrated by Moscow in order to justify the annexation of Crimea and spark a separatist movement in the
east. That became the narrative, is that, and the same way that George Soros said that the opposition, the new government that we put into power there, Arseniy Yatsenyuk and others that took control before we could have the first elections, before Poroshenko was elected, that new government, their narrative was that the Russians had ordered Yanukovych to order the police to start firing, and they're the ones who started firing. The Yanukovych government, to this day, if you go back and you look at Ukraine on Fire, which Oliver Stone did, they deny that they did any shooting first. And then you have this BBC guy saying that he was shooting at both sides, that he was shooting at the protesters, and then he started shooting at the police. And his story lines up perfectly with this phone conversation. I want you to look at the date of this conversation. The date of this conversation is March 5th, 2014. This is a conversation between the foreign minister of Estonia. His name is Urmas Paet. And then Catherine Ashton is the security service officer of the ousted Yanukovych government, is what it says here. Officers of security service of Ukraine's loyal to the ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. So the phones were hacked. The phone call was hacked. And this conversation between the person representing the security service of Ukraine and the foreign minister of Estonia. Take a listen to this conversation. And this is just a week. 2 weeks after the shooting had started there in February 20th.
Yeah. Short impressions.
No, very, very interesting. I've just had a big meeting here with Olly Rehn and the other commissioners to talk about what we can do. I mean, we're working on financial packages, short, medium, long term. Everything from how we get money in quickly, how we support the IMF, and how we get a kind of investment packages and business leaders and so on. On the political side, we've worked out resources we've got, and I offered to civil society and to...
Yep. It's really difficult. I hope you guys are able to hear her, because she's talking about how they're trying to bring an end to this, and they're negotiating with civil society. So George Soros is involved with all of the negotiations the whole time this is going on. I hope you're able to hear this. I'll put this in the show notes so you can check it out yourself.
How we support the IMF and how we get a kind of investment packages and business leaders and so on. On the political side, we've worked out resources we've got, and I offered to civil society and to Yatsenyuk and Klitschko and everybody I met yesterday, we can offer you people who know how to do political and economic reform. The countries that are closest to Ukraine have themselves been through dramatic changes and have done big political and economic reforms. So we've got loads of experience to give you, which we're happy to give. I said to the people in Maidan, yes, you want real reforms, but you've got to get through the short term first. So you need to find ways in which you can establish a process that will have anti-corruption at its heart, that will have people working alongside until the elections, and that you can be confident in the process. And I said to Olga, you may not be health minister now, but you need to think about becoming health minister in the future, because people like you are going to be needed to be able to get and make sure that all happens. But I've also said to them, if you simply barricade the buildings now and the government doesn't function, we can't get money in, because we need a partner to partner with.
Absolutely.
And I've said to the opposition leaders shortly to become government, you need to reach out to Maidan, you need to be, engaging with them. You also need to get ordinary police officers back on the streets under a new sense of their role so that people feel safe. I said to the Party of the Regions people, you have to go and lay flowers where the people died. You have to show that you understand what has happened here.
Absolutely.
Because what you're experiencing is anger of people who've seen the way that Yanukovych lived and the corruption, and they assume you're all the same. Mm. And those are the people who've lost people and who feel that, he ordered that to happen. There's quite a lot of shock.
So listen to what she says. She goes, and there's a lot of people who feel that Yanukovych ordered the shooting. So listen to what she says.
And those are the people who've lost people and who feel that, he ordered that to happen. There's quite a lot of shock, I think, in the city, a lot of sadness and shock, and that's going to come out in some very strange ways if they're not careful. So I think all of this we just have to work on. So we've done a big meeting here today to try and get this in place. But, very interesting, your observation.
It is.
So she says, so she's telling the Estonian foreign minister, what's going on the ground? We're meeting. We're trying to get money in, working with civil society. A lot of people are angry. They feel that Yanukovych is the one who ordered the shooting to start. And then listen to the foreign minister from Estonia, and who he heard started the shooting.
Actually, the only politician the people from civil society mentioned positively was Poroshenko.
Yeah.
So listen, I think that's interesting too, because they're talking about new leadership, and he says the people from civil society, George Soros, civil society, are putting forward Poroshenko. Poroshenko, when they finally do have elections, Poroshenko is the first president that is elected. So I think that's
Poroshenko. So that he has some sort of, how to say, trust among all these Maidan people.
He's saying that Poroshenko has some trust with the people of Maidan. So Poroshenko is the guy that he's thinking that could be the new leader. And again, once they do have election, Poroshenko is the one who is elected.
Actually, the only politician the people from civil society mentioned positively was Poroshenko. So that he has some sort of, how to say, trust among all these Maidan people and civil society. And second, what was quite disturbing, the same Olga told that, all the evidence shows that people who were killed by snipers from both sides, among policemen and people from the streets, that they were the same snipers.
Listen to that. This is what the Estonian foreign minister says, that all of the evidence shows that the snipers who were sniping at both factions, that they were sniping at the police and they were sniping at the protesters. This is the Estonian foreign minister who says this, that whoever was shooting, whoever started the shooting, the snipers, that the ones who started all of this war, the war that we're currently in right now, that person, that provocateur, and you got somebody that the BBC is interviewing who's admitting to the fact that, yeah, I was shooting at both sides. I was shooting at the feet of the protesters and I shot up at the police to get the shooting started. And then the Estonian foreign minister says all the evidence shows that the person who started the shooting was shooting at both sides.
The people who were listening.
They're listening again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that he has some sort of, how to say, trust among all these Maidan people and civil society. And second, what was quite disturbing, the same Olga told that, well, all the evidence shows that people who were killed by snipers from both sides, among policemen and people from the streets, that they were the same snipers killing people from both sides.
Well, that's...
So that, and then she also showed me some photos. She said that has medical doctor, she can, you know, say that it is the same handwriting, the same type of bullets. And it's really disturbing that now the new coalition, that they don't want to investigate what exactly happened. So that there is now stronger and stronger understanding that behind snipers, it was not Yanukovych, but it was somebody.
It was somebody. Somebody. Who was it? It was somebody. We don't know who the somebody was. Who's the somebody? Who's the somebody who started the shooting? Who's the somebody who started the shooting at both sides to start them shooting at each other, which started the war? Who did that? Putin says it was CIA. Putin says it was CIA. Would the CIA do anything like that? I don't know. I don't know if the CIA would do anything like that. Maybe it wasn't the CIA. Maybe it was someone who was contracted by the CIA. And you got this guy on this on the BBC being interviewed, covering his face, not telling you who he is. This guy says that he says I was shooting. Can we get this guy and ask him who put him up to it? Was it CIA? Was it MI6? Who put you up to shooting at both sides, shooting at the police and shooting at the protesters to get the shooting started? Well, nevertheless, once the shooting started, the violence started. And when the violence started.
But.
I mean, most Americans don't even know what happened in Euromaidan. It's so sad that most Americans don't even. We're paying all this money and we don't even know how it started, how the meddling from our politicians, started this. And I want you to take a look at some of these images of some of the violence that took place at Euromaidan. This is before Russia doesn't invade until 2022. This is long before Russia invades. The war had already started. People were dying. This is what was going on. Take a look.
The clashes centered around Hereshkovo Street on the eastern edge of the Maidan, where new barricades had been set up and a shaky ceasefire was in place. So we're down at the barricades. The ceasefire passed an hour and a half ago, and so far everything's still peaceful. But now, if you want to go through to the front barricades, you have to put your helmet on. This is the very front line. There's two sets of barricades here. Everyone's got makeshift weapon, shield, armor. Guys have got like bits of polystyrene strapped to their shins, bits of plastic on their arms, ready to defend themselves from the police.
This is how the war started. This is how the coup started, people.
A catapult. At the feet of the guys, there's probably at least 50 petrol
bombs.
Since Sunday, at least two people have been confirmed killed. They were shot dead. And the protesters here shining torches up into the buildings on the police side, looking for any cops that might want to shoot any protesters. In the early days of the protests, the opposition parties were influential on the streets. But now, after weeks of stagnation, protesters were getting tired of the continuing political stalemate.
На мою думку, зараз ситуація в Україні така, що ми бачимо бездіяльність.
And some more video of the actual violence. Look at some of this stuff. This lasted for weeks, people. Weeks. that say January 6th was a coup. This is a real coup. This is, and look at this. This is all of this is the Yanukovych government, and they are holding off the opposition, which includes Nazis. But by this time, even people that aren't Nazis are participating in the violence because the violence was set off once the shooting started. Here's some more video. Take a look. Think that the war started in 2022 when Russia invaded. There's people who think that this war started in 2022. So again, all of this is happening in the Capitol, and hold on, where am I at? Here we go. All this is happening in Kiev. All this is happening in the capital city. All that violence that I just showed you is happening here in the capital city. The people in Odessa, the people in Crimea, the people in Donbass, these people are watching this madness take place and this coup d'etat take place in their capital city. And they don't support it. A lot of them don't support it. I'm going to show you that in the next podcast, how the people in those regions reacted to what was taking place in Kiev. And we'll pick this up in the next podcast. You know, all of this has to do with our meddling. And now they're telling you that if we don't continue to meddle, we don't continue putting gas on this fire, we don't continue sending weapons that eventually that your sons and daughters are going to have to go to Ukraine and fight in World War III. It's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, that the probability of your sons and daughters having to go to Eastern Europe to fight increases the more gas we throw on this fire, the more weapons we throw into this. It doesn't decrease, it increases the more that we ramp this up. We need to force them to negotiate peace now, and we're going to talk about what that peace will entail in the next podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I'll see you on Friday.